Professor Steve Fuller is answering questions after his lecture, Dissent Over Descent, Intelligent Design's Challenge to Darwinism, at the Bateman Auditorium in Gonville and Caius College, Cambridge, on Saturday the 11th of July 2009. The event was organised by Genesis Agendum. If you'd like to know more about our aims and our work, please see our website, www.genesisagendum.org.uk.
Thank you very much for your talk. I find it a very compelling case that you make for the recognition of the contingency of science, not only among philosophers and historians, but also among school children, and that science is really steeped in religion. I think is very important for anyone attempting to understand the scientific enterprise. What puzzles me is why you then championed intelligent design in the courtroom instead of any other sort of deistic approach to teaching theory in the classroom, because it seems to me that the sort of perspective that you're arguing for, this really informed contingent perspective on science, is very much that. It's a perspective. And intelligent design is a very popular theory. It's being pushed as a scientific theory, and it's a bad theory. It's been broadly recognized that it is a bad theory by, you know, almost every leading biologist. So my question is, if you want our children to grow up as spiritually and intellectually critical, fulfilled, strong people, why teach them bad theory? Why not argue for a sort of contingent historical and philosophical casing for their scientific education instead?
Okay, first of all, I actually don't think intelligent design theory is a unified theory, to be perfectly honest. I think the reason why it has that kind of impression is, in a way, its PR has been determined by its opponents. Okay, and I also think that you are raising a very important kind of practical point that I would always, again, it's another kind of health warning issue. At the end of the day, you want to judge these things by the actual curricular materials that are being presented. And I think one of the things that, of course, was very damaging to intelligent design theory as it was presented in the Pennsylvania case was a particular textbook that was being offered for it, which was kind of warmed over young Earth creationist textbook where just a few words were changed, blah, 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 okay? And that was, and that was very damning. And in terms of my involvement in the case, okay, for what it's worth, the defense team thought that they could run a kind of two-tier argument, right? So in other words, there was this business of defending what was actually happening in the school board with regard to actually putting this textbook on there, blah, blah, blah. But they sort of thought, and I don't think I'm speaking out of school here, you know, they thought that was a losing proposition. That it was quite clear that these people were using intelligent design as a fig leaf for young Earth creationism. And they thought they were going to lose that side of the case. What they didn't anticipate was that the judge would use that as evidence for just dismissing intelligent design altogether as warmed over creationism. You see, and I was instructed not to actually look at the textbook before offering my opinions. And my opinions, if you read what I've said, are very directly related to what the opposing experts were saying, which is basically that supernatural agency has had no positive role in the history of science. Okay, so if you think about the argument I'm making now, right, that's kind of the kind of where I was coming from on this case. Because you had people on the other side, when they're representing the history and philosophy of science, basically saying, well, you know, science progresses by getting rid of these notions about God and supernatural agency and so forth. No, I don't believe that's what happens at all. What happens is they get operationalized. They, you know, in other words, action at a distance, all this kind of stuff that you might think is kind of spooky stuff that's going on that, you know, indicates that God somehow is doing something, that stuff gets incorporated into science and you come up with ways of operationalizing that. And that is what I think people like Priestley and so forth were on about. And they were thinking about this very much in an intelligent design perspective.
But that's theism, right? I mean, that's paleo theism.
Yes, but the point in intelligent design, see, you make it sound like intelligent design is this unified view with a very specific religious ideology behind it.
No. I'm talking simply about the intelligent design of people like Behe or Michael Dembski, which
actually,
I think
somewhat different. But the point
okay,
is
sure, but like,
but they're being attacked together, right? And this is the point, right? They're attacked together. And there is no incentive, actually, for, I mean, and again, I think you are pointing out a genuine problem here, namely, where is the space for critical discussion among people who generally hold this kind of view? Because there are differences of opinion between people who hold this view. I agree. But I don't think there is really a space hasn't been publicly opened for that, because I think everybody kind of feels besieged. And so they all stick together and they minimize their differences. But there are differences, not just between me and them, but even among the people who are part of the Discovery Institute. Okay? And I think, in a sense, that is quite typical of what happens when these kinds of, you know, very subtle kind of intellectual discussions become, you know, political hot-button topics. Right? People start, you know, so for example, let's do it the other way around, right, with the evolutionists. Do they all agree? I mean, in terms of to what extent is natural selection a primary mechanism of evolution? You've got a wide range of opinions on that one, but everybody, when they're in the courtroom, they're defending natural selection. Because that's, as it were, the banner topic for evolution vis-a-vis intelligent design.
I don't really see the relevance. I mean, my question is, why promote a certain theory? Which, I agree that, you know, Dembski, Fihi, all these people have diverse ideas. Those ideas were unified into pandas and people, which I think actually is not a young creationist text. I think it's very much a Discovery Institute creation. But anyway, that is a theoretical orientation that's being opposed to natural selection. And my question is, why oppose scientific theories instead of opposing the pedagogical orientation that's being promoted in American
culture? Okay, maybe you're... Okay, here's the thing. Okay, so this is a choice in a way, is an existential choice for me. Okay? This is not really an intellectual question, what you're asking. It's a question of whether you want to be involved in an ongoing discussion, which is kind of where the action is on this topic. I mean, of course, as academics, we can invent ways of discussing this matter. Okay? We can write articles saying, well, really the debate is about this, and really the debate is about that. Right? We do that all the time. Right? And if you read my stuff, you'll see I kind of reconfigure the stuff in a way that might be unrecognizable to someone who just understands it from the newspapers. But I think there's a kind of existential question when a lawyer comes up to you and says, look, there's a trial here, and the trial's about this versus that, and here's the situation. And we're wondering whether you're willing to do this in this trial. That's how you decide, right? You make your decision. And the situation is never ideal, right? It's never the way you'd like it to be. Okay? And I decided to do what I did. And I don't regret it. The one thing I had in the back of my mind was whether I could get fired over it. No. And one of the things that's really very important about this kind of issue is that I don't, you know, as we might say, this is not something for you to do in your homes, all right? I mean, you really need to be in a certain kind of position to take this kind of decision, okay? Because I think most people would say, no, the question's not being framed right, there are too many uncertainties here, you know, it's not how I would think about it if I were, you know, asked to put the question forward. And you know, people, and this is what most academics do, of course, right? Most academics just back off, okay? Especially if they're going to be on the underdog side. I mean, even the guys who are on the side of the winners, the Darwinists, those guys take a lot of flack too. Okay? But no, I thought, you're not going to get this sort of discussion that we're talking about right now were it not for this trial, frankly. I don't think I would have been invited here. Okay? I don't think all of this, the book, I wouldn't have gotten the book contracts. I wouldn't have gotten the platform. And I think for a lot of other people, that's very important. It would have just been a marginal academic discussion otherwise. Okay? I mean, you have to think about this as a long game. This is not something where you win it in one case, and if you don't win the case, then it's a disaster. No, it's a matter of a long-term commitment where you think there's something quite important here, and it maybe hasn't been expressed quite adequately yet, but you keep on pushing along, and if you're institutionally protected, which, you know, you're a tenured professor, I mean, see, for me, that's what tenure's for. Okay? Tenure's for taking these kinds of risks, because, you know, I wasn't fired. I got a lot of hate mail, but I wasn't fired. Okay? And I do think this is kind of the issue here, right? How serious? See, I actually think this is a very serious issue, and that's why I got involved. even though it's, you're right, it's not the ideal circumstances for somebody like me to get involved in it. But where is that great Deist textbook out there, frankly? You know, where is it? Who's doing it? It's not happening yet. It may happen in the future, okay? But I think you've got to be out there doing something. If you're, I'm not recommending this for people who are vulnerable, okay? If you're institutionally vulnerable, you know, and so forth, sure, I understand why you keep your head down. But if you've got, you know, if you know the score on this, and you can offer an alternative point of view, I don't see why not go out there and just stay with it. You see, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's, people have different, you know, you can't invent the controversies you intervene in. They happen. They're out there already. You have the choice of either getting involved or disappearing. I don't know. There's a point at which that it's an existential choice.
I guess. I mean, the distinctions matter to me because it's going to be my children whose education is on the line.
Yeah, but look, nothing, as you well know, nothing's happened yet. As you know, intelligent design people lost. So do you feel threatened? What do you feel threatened by exactly? By what exactly? What are you threatened by? Because that I don't... See, here's the thing. The more I'm involved in this, the more the idea of the threat of intelligent design doesn't make sense to me. Because the more I understand what these people are about and so forth, I don't know what it is you're threatened by. What is it exactly? How would you summarize it?
By the way in which the debate is taking place, that what we are presented with is two opposing theories. One saying that there's an interventionist deity who steps in at certain moments in chemistry, in biomolecular changes, in the evolution of the world, and the other that says that there is no such deity, that this can be a naturalistic process. And this discussion is being brought into the classrooms of our children. The debate is then about whether this is one of the religious theory and one isn't, and it then becomes a war between religion and science. What I see is one good scientific theory and one bad scientific theory, which to me is irrelevant to the question of whether our children need some kind of complex understanding of the relationship between science and religion. So what I would like is for historians and philosophers of science to stop talking about intelligent design at all and talk instead about the way that science is conceived in education. And what I'm worried about is that if the question of whether or not intelligent design is scientific or not scientific gets settled, let's say the intelligent design case wins such that it's agreed that, you know, anything can be taught in a scientific classroom, I'm then worried that a Christian, Abrahamic, whatever you want to call it, worldview will be forced on my children when those aren't my beliefs.
Well, look, I think you should wait for all those, you know, you shouldn't presume all those things are going to happen before they actually happen. That's the first thing, okay? Because you're really kind of extrapolating wildly here, it seems to me.
But what do you want to have happen? What was your goal?
Well, my goal is actually to move in the direction we're talking, because I actually think there's a crisis in the future of science, frankly, okay? I actually think, you know, in terms of people being motivated for the right reasons to do science, that is disappearing. And as I've thought about this more and more, right, if we're not going to accept the theological reason for doing science, we've got to come up with a much better one than it makes money for us, okay? And it works, okay? Because this business of it works, it's just completely dangerous if left as the final word on science. Okay? And I don't know where you're coming from, frankly, because if you're trying to teach kids about science, you're not just trying to teach them a load of facts that happens to be the current state of knowledge. Presumably, you're trying to teach them about some kind of, you know, way of understanding the world, and potentially one that they would want to get involved in which case then you do need to talk about motivation. You do need to say, why do people think about these things? Why do they come up with these kinds of ideas?
So you don't believe that a humanist tradition has sufficient ethics or values?
Humanism is parasitic on the theological one. This is the problem. Humanism is basically secular theology, right? Because if you're a Darwinist, you shouldn't be a humanist, right? Because according to Darwinism, right, there is no privilege to human beings. We're just a minor genetic accident, and given the way we've been going, especially with our science, we're bound to kill ourselves. Right? I mean, the confidence that we have in science, right, does not come from a Darwinian perspective. Right? I mean, No, in fact, that's one of the things. I mean, I had, you know, as I said in the talk, I didn't go into the business about Darwin's own views, but Darwin is a complete pessimist about the human condition. Okay? He's a pessimist in all kinds of ways. So, for example, I don't think you can blame Darwin for eugenics, for example, because Darwin didn't have that kind of confidence that we could actually control the gene pool. It wasn't that he was, you know, it wasn't that he was necessarily against our having better human beings. He just thought we'd never figure it out. Okay? And he basically thought that at the end of the day, like all creatures, we come and we go. End of story. And all the rest of it are just delusions. Okay? And, you know, what I would like to see done, and this is something I say in my writings a lot, Darwin has spent a lot of time trying to explain religion. I'd like them to explain science. Explain science as it's actually happened, the way it's gone, the direction it's gone, the degree of, the way in which it's kind of come to comprehend and sort of totalize over our way of understanding things. Explain that from a Darwinian perspective. It isn't because it works. It puts us in increasingly risky positions. But risky positions that we think we'll always be able to overcome. Okay? Now, where does that confidence come from? It doesn't come from Darwin. Right? We think we're better. We think we're special. And of course the humanists think all this. But where do the humanists get this kind of idea from? It can't be from Darwin. Because Darwin doesn't give them any grounds for that. You see, the old humanism of the 19th century, right, was never a kind of unalloyed Darwinism. It always had that Lamarckian thing going on. It still had that progressive evolution thing going on, where human beings are kind of the crown of creation, you know, and where evolution is imagined as a teleological project where the species get better and better and better, and the humans are the next stop before God. Okay? But of course, if you're a pure Darwinist, you get Lamarck out of the picture, there's no grounds for this kind of human self-confidence in Darwinism. Not at all. You know, that's why, you know, I mean, Richard Dawkins is amazing because, you know, he actually still has a lot of that confidence. He has that kind of old 19th century confidence in humanity and so forth. But I'm wondering, from the standpoint of the strict Darwinian perspective, where does that come from? I can see it coming from a sort of theological perspective. You know, any problem we have, we'll be able to overcome. I mean, I for those of you, if you want to see an interesting kind of transition point, as you know, Darwin's theory of natural selection was very much influenced by Thomas Malthus, right? And Thomas Malthus was one of these downer guys. But the person he was responding to was the Marquis de Condorcet, this sort of French Enlightenment figure, okay, who's a big humanist. And his view was, sure, we have problems in the world. There's poverty. He's reflecting on all these things in the late 18th century. But the more people we have, the more brains we'll have working on this, and the more likely we'll be able to overcome everything. Just having more human beings, doing more thinking, and more doing will do it. That is not a Darwinian point of view, okay? That is a view that actually kind of privileges the capacity of the human intellect. Okay? And again, where does that come from? That doesn't come from Darwin.
I just want to ask you about this problem that intelligent design, and the same thing applies to creationism, are defined by their enemies.
Yeah.
And what can be done about it? Because even definition of intelligent design given tonight, I would say, is a very truncated one promoted by enemies, you know, not the real thing. So what can we do about it?
Well, I do think this is, as I said before, I think this is a long game that has to be fought on many fronts. But I do think from a practical standpoint, in terms of the issues that she was raising up there, the textbook issue, the curricular material issues, it's not a matter of coming up with a definition that everybody can agree on, because even evolution, there isn't an agreed definition, contrary to what the proponents say. But what matters is that you can get, as it were, textbooks that can pass the relevant standards. I really think it's a very practical question in a way. It's how you write your textbooks, how you present your curricular materials. Okay? And I'm not saying that you hide stuff. Not at all. I actually believe, and this is where I disagree with a lot of these guys in the Discovery Institute, because there is a tendency on the part of the Discovery Institute to sort of stress the design over the intelligence. Okay? So in other words, to get God out of the picture or any idea that there's some sort of larger kind of plus, you know. So you just look at patterns, right? So mathematical patterns that seem that couldn't have been generated randomly, right? That kind of becomes kind of the primary database for intelligent design, and often the argument doesn't go much beyond that. And I think, oh, come on, there's no theory there. That's what we're talking about, right? What you have to do is you have to actually have a theory of intelligence. Okay? And so I do think this is where I strongly recommend that people show how, in fact, the theological motivation actually does lead to science that even people who do not share that motivation agree on. That's the challenge for the intelligent design people from a curricular standpoint. Not to deny the theology, not to background it or anything, okay? Because it's there and there's nothing to be ashamed of. But what you have to show is that that kind of theological impetus actually leads to scientific results that people who do not share the theological beginnings accept. That's what it boils down to.
Would you not say there's a big problem with the very definition of the word science? Because the early scientists you've described tonight hardly would be defined as such today. So when you're saying there is no danger to science, is one problem that the science of Newton and co. was actually not the same thing.
But the reason why it's always powerful to bring up Newton is Newton's an icon for everybody.
Yeah.
You see, this is an important point, right? You bring up people like Newton, you bring up, let's say, the Catholic monk Gregor Mendel. These are people who, regardless of when they lived, even the people on the other side believe are scientists. Okay, that's a very important, because in a way, you have to show you're still part of the same tradition. I mean, I think a big mistake is to think of intelligent design as somehow this kind of, other, totally different thing, right? Because then it starts to get lumped in with, Chinese science or something like that, right? But we're actually talking about, we're talking about the sort of other side of the same tradition.
I mean, I've actually worked in two biological research laboratories, and they both operated from a design perspective. Whatever they may actually have believed, it was design that was underlying what they were doing, not a random evolutionary perspective.
No, I don't think it's that hard. I do think one of the problems, especially, and again, I think we have to always keep in mind just how anchored this discussion is in the American political situation, right, where the business of the separation of church and state is kind of the lightning rod issue for the discussion. I mean, we wouldn't be having this discussion, we wouldn't have all these court cases, if it wasn't for the sort of ambiguity in how, one interprets the separation of church and state in the United States. But it seems to me that putting that aside, actually making the relevance of theology to the development of science explicit. It's not just that Newton believed in God, right? And this is the thing. It's not, in other words, you should not cast these scientific icons as somehow having segregated minds. I think that's the biggest mistake in the world. And often the rhetoric on both sides looks like that. And of course, the Darwinists can win the argument that way. They say, sure, yeah, and Newton maybe liked the color blue, right? I mean, the point is, it's arbitrary. It's an arbitrary thing. It doesn't matter. Yeah. And see, in education, this issue of motivation really matters because when you teach kids, right, again, it's not just about teaching them what's right and what's wrong in terms of, which facts are believed now or not. It's about motivating them to go forward, right, to challenge the taken-for-granted views. And so then you have to think about, well, what kinds of ideas do you need to have to do that? Right, and that's part of what education is about. And that's why this debate is appropriately handled at the secondary school level and not at the university. Because at the university, it's too late. Okay? So there, I really think that this is not a misplaced discussion at all in terms of it happening about high school science teaching.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure.
I wonder if you could sum up why the Orthodox Church, or the established churches in this country, are opposed to intelligent design. Very much in brief, and then summarise why you...
I don't know. Well, it's kind of, here's the thing you've got to keep in mind. The view of the Anglican Church is not so different from the Catholic Church on this matter, okay? And I think very often when one thinks about Catholic attitudes toward this thing, there's a tendency to fixate on Galileo. But if you put Galileo aside, who is a kind of a bit too Protestant for his own good, Catholic Church has actually had a very accommodating relationship with the history of science, had much less trouble with Darwin than it did with Galileo, okay? And I think the reason is because you get to this kind of, this thing that's nowadays called theistic evolution, where basically you sort of come up with this accommodation where you say, God maybe started it all or got the ball rolling in some sense. There's some kind of prior moment or some sort of prior metaphysical framework. But it's all kind of like in the outside. And then science continues in a business as usual manner. Because what that means then is, that there's never going to be any kind of direct theological or religious challenge to science. But what you end up having is a segregated worldview. Okay? And it seems to me that, if you believe you're creating the image and likeness of God, and one of the things you're supposed to do is to be able to understand the nature of things, okay, then that is going to be challenging stuff all over the place, not only the established churches, but also the established sciences. And the problem with the Anglican view and the Catholic view is they basically want orthodoxy across the board. They want a kind of, minimal accommodation. You see, somebody like Galileo is a very interesting figure because Galileo is somebody who, in a sense, reads the Bible and looks at the stars and is trying to put it together for himself and ends up getting conflict everywhere. Okay? And in a sense, intelligent design theory is in that position. And as you know, those of you who know about this debate, intelligent design theory is not loved by either very orthodox religious people, like, for example, the Anglican Church, and it's not loved by the scientific community either, because it's challenging on both grounds. But at the end of the day, if you believe that, in a sense, science and theology do need to be together, this is if we're, that there's a theological imperative to do science, there ought to be a unified understanding. And it's not just one where you sort of delegate one bit to one side or one bit to the other. So for example, in the trial, the Kitzmiller trial, one of the ways in which this kind of segregation is expressed is in terms of, they go back to Aristotle, and they talk about the difference between how and the why questions. Science is about how, and religion is about why, and we're supposed to understand that to mean they're different questions. And that, we've kind of, as the word division of labor, somehow got established, right? I don't know, at some point, Jesus said something to St. Peter, and then, whatever, somebody said something to the Royal Society, and that's how it goes. No, seriously, because it seems that is what we're talking about here with regard to the sort of view that you have within Anglicanism and the Catholic Church on this matter. Right?
I was thinking in particular then of Michael Rice. He was advocating really what you're saying, wasn't he? Let's bring the debate into the science room, and he was, though, would take that point to show that intelligent design was wrong. And I'm still not clear.
Well, look. I think the thing to take from the Michael Rice case is the fact that he got sacked simply for saying that if a student raises issues about creationism, they should be taken seriously, even if they're refuted.
Yes.
He got sacked for that,
right.
Not for anything even remotely close to what I'm saying.
Yes.
But he got sacked that early, as it were, in the argument.
Yes. Except that. But his basic point, though, wasn't it, to encourage the debate in the science room with the children, along the lines you're suggesting, but his basic personal views were against intelligent design. And I'm not clear as to why he is opposed to intelligent design.
I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. To be honest with you, I don't know the man personally. I don't know why he holds what he holds personally. I do believe though that what he did say at that British Association for the Advancement of Science meeting last year was fine. And I thought it was abominable that he got sacked on the basis of it. But you're right. I don't know why he had this kind of segregation. Because, there was a little symposium in Oxford, when was it? Maybe last year. Mary Midgley, you may know the philosopher Mary Midgley, did a paper, a paper for the Society for the Philosophy of Education on whether intelligent design ought to be taught in classrooms and so forth. And she basically said, no, but Dawkins shouldn't be allowed either, kind of thing. Michael Rice and myself and Peter Harrison, who I mentioned in my talk, we were all speakers at this thing. Rice, I don't know if you've ever seen this guy, Michael Rice. You might think he's some kind of firebrand. He's the ultimate moderate. He's like pathologically moderate, okay? And yet he got sacked. For me, the thing is, he got sacked. I mean, unbelievable. It just shows you how serious this issue is. Right? I mean, unbelievable. Oh, never mind.
I think Michael Rice is typical of many within the Christian community and maybe even the evangelical Christian community that are committed to Darwinism. And I would take issue with our friend at the back, although she may not think this, that we have a good theory in natural selection, random mutation, natural selection, but actually it's a very weak theory. There are aspects of it that are true. There are things that cannot possibly be true. What is it going to take, do you think, for there to be a greater openness in the scientific community with respect to intelligent design? What's it going to take for Darwinism really to be killed off? And the fact is this, that every academic paper, particularly in genomics that is coming out, puts another nail into the coffin of Darwin. To take for the paradigm shift? And what will it, what will be its manifestation? What will it be like? Because presumably we're not talking of a religious revival here. We're talking of a further development in secular science, but moving away from Darwinism. What will it be like, do you think, Steve?
Well, in terms of the change that's necessary, first of all, as I said in response to you, this is a long process, and I think part of it also is that people have to get used to what the views are, okay? And I do think there's a kind of collective educational process that's going on, those of you in the audience, think about, well, exactly how much do you know about what this whole debate's about when it gets right down to it, right? And so there's nothing wrong with, as it were, having this thing go on for a while, okay? Especially since there are a lot of committed and very articulate people, and I do think the arguments are getting better. And I think a lot of the old stereotypes are just gradually disappearing. It takes a while. But see, I would make the argument, this is, again, I think I'm very much alone in this regard. I actually do think that a very crucial point of intervention is the high school. Because look, here's something I don't believe. I don't believe there's going to be some kind of crucial knockdown moment in the scientific lab somewhere. You see, and I think that kind of rhetoric is just really bad. And to a certain extent, the intelligent design people have contributed to it, a lot of Michael Behe's rhetoric in the Darwin's black box thing was all about how natural selection could not possibly explain how, bacterial flagellum evolved, blah, blah, blah. Now, the response then is, what do you mean, cannot possibly explain? Of course we can possibly explain it. We've got all these models of what might have happened billions of years ago. Right? Of course, we don't know which one of them is right, if any of them is right, and it's going to be pretty hard to figure out whether we're going to know what's happened over all those many billions of years. Okay? But the problem is, if the rhetoric is, natural selection cannot possibly, if that's what your argument is, right, that's overstating the point. Right? What one has to say is, it is unlikely that one would have discovered this, that, or the other thing unless one thought the thing had been intelligently designed.
It has to be a positive argument. Okay? And that's where the issue about the science textbooks come in. Because basically what you want to show to students is that somebody starting off with a kind of intelligent design framework, okay, maybe with rather weird theological views, but still they're there, nevertheless is able to come up with scientifically credible results. And it seems to me that you want to get the next generation kind of, as it were, sensitized to that sort of possibility. Because I really don't think this is going to be a matter of people changing other people's minds on. I think the most you're going to see is certain people who have been kind of quiet at this point coming out one way or the other on the matter. But I do think the interesting issue is the next generation of people and how they learn about science. And I think that the people who are supportive of intelligent design, I think should make a bigger deal about the crisis that science is in at the moment. You know, that science is just up for hire, right? That science is corrupt. I mean, you know, that science is debased in its current form. Okay? I think that ought to be stressed more strongly. Okay? My own personal view, if I had to, offer strategic advice, is to still go for the secondary schools. Still go for the secondary schools. That's where the action still is. And especially in this country where you don't have all this kind of legal minefield that you have in the United States. In fact, you have an established church in this country.
The remark that Michael Behe said about it couldn't possibly happen. This may be a very oversimple question, but where does logic come into all this?
Well, I think where logic comes in is in terms of issue of burden of proof, right? Who has to prove what about what exactly in this matter? Because I mean, one of the interesting things, if you're let's say a completely neutral observer to this debate, one of the things that's amazing to a neutral observer is just how each side thinks the other has proved very little, right? And that they have these impossible burdens of proof to overcome. Right? So, for example, I think if you're an intelligent design theorist, your general view, and I have to say, this is a view that I have myself become more inclined toward as a result of being involved in the controversy, that if really natural selection is the big mechanism that evolutionists make it out to be, or at least some evolutionists make it out to be, then boy, you better hope that, the Earth and the universe are really, really old, I think. I really think so. And if we ever get to a position where, our dating methods change, so we end up knocking a few zeros off, that would be a serious problem, it seems to me, for that side. Okay? And so frankly, I'm making career advice for people who want to pursue a kind of creationist intelligent design line is to go to, radiometric dating, of fossils and things. Right? Because all these methodologies are potentially fallible. Okay? And I think with the Darwinian picture, you really do need to have a long time frame in order for it to appear plausible. And if it got truncated in a very substantial way, because I think there is this kind of presumption that the more we study the way the world works, nature works, and so forth, we're going to find everything's older and older and older and older. And that always helps the Darwinist presumption. But why do we have to presume that? Why can't things contract? Why can't we suddenly realize, oh my God, we overestimated? You see, because I think that, so you can be kind of, so if you're thinking about if people have a kind of creationist or intelligent design perspective and you're thinking about, what sort of careers should they go into in science, there are certain sorts of areas where, in a sense, the Darwinists are really committed to a certain kind of position that would be very hard for them to reorganize from if it was shown to be false. Right? And these are typically having to do with methods issues, the methods by which you tell how old something is, for example. So, there are some strategic things that one can do.
Any other questions?
I got a couple of remarks before the question. Everybody agrees in the scientific world, in my view, and I'm a part of it, so I'm speaking in my name partly, that Darwinism is a theory, a budding theory, that is still improving, and epigenetics, in that sense, is one big stone in the building of like this, like a scientific theory, I think. So that's my first remark. And the, my second remark is, you talk as a starting point as a problem of motivation of people doing science. I work in an institute and in this university where I've not met, I mean, every people I work with, biologists, and I'm a biologist, are believe in evolution. And I've worked in the US, I've worked in India, I've worked in many places, met many people, and they're all extremely motivated by something in that, that money, as you raised. And there is an inner motivation that is different than theology.
Yeah.
And what, where do come from, when the, where does that fear of like this lack of motivation is going to kill science come from? Because I don't see it, and I couldn't see it in any high school where I teached for, I taught, sorry.
Okay,
so, and are there numbers of like lack of scientists, are there like statistics, and where does this crisis of science come from, and where is this, where does this belief of like the lack of fundamental science, because I that's what I do, and I see a lot of people doing that too, come from.
Okay, first of all, it's, let's see, how to put this. Maybe I should be more specific here. Yes, I can understand that people can have a kind of inner motivation for doing science that isn't very explicitly theological. I guess part of what I'm talking about here is why anyone else should take it seriously. Right? I mean, it's one thing for you to be driven by what a particular bacteria is doing, okay? But why this has such, you know, larger significance that require, you know, requires national funding, even if the results aren't of practical benefit and are somehow, you know, why do people think this thing has a kind of larger significance that can feed into some sort of larger picture of how reality is and so forth? I mean, it seems to me that if we're talking about especially public funding for science, that larger picture has to be there somehow, okay? I mean, one of the things that was very interesting, in the early 1990s in the United States, you know, there was this move by Congress to fund the Super Collider, which would have been the largest particle accelerator in the world, and it failed. And the Congress at that point was sort of scaling down the science budgets from the Cold War and all the rest of it, and these guys got kind of caught up in that. And it was interesting because you brought all these Nobel Prize-winning physicists like Steven Weinberg to defend the Super Collider, and you know they talked a lot about aesthetics, and you know they talked about the inner motivation of scientists, you know, and why this is an important thing. You know, the congressman looked at them and said, "Is that it? I mean, you know, we're going to spend $10 billion so you guys can indulge your fantasies?" Right? I mean, you see, there's a sense of inner motivation, you know, if it's understood in a very strict sense, like I feel motivated to go to my lab every day and spend 16 hours because I'm really fascinated by trivial stuff, okay, that's not enough to justify the existence of science, I'm afraid. Well, you have to somehow make an argument that there is some kind of absolute conception of reality, some larger unified conception of reality that you're getting after. You know, so for example, you know, Steven Weinberg says, well, you know, we're trying to get the fundamental forces of nature unified. And suppose your congressman asks, well, why do you think these things are there to be unified anyway? I mean, you know, what are you talking about? Is this just a kind of metaphysical illusion, some metaphysical fantasy? Some kind of picture you've got in your mind and a few of your friends do and you've managed to kind of fleece the government for the last few years? I mean, what are you talking about? Yeah, sure. Okay, grand unified theory. That's a nice game. You get a private funder for it. Why should I care? Why should the public care? You see, I mean, how do you answer that question? You see, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the interesting thing about the debate as it arose with the super collider was, you know, people like Weinberg had gotten so used to physics having this kind of prerogative, you know, that everybody would bow down to them and everything. And what they failed to realize was, in fact, the reason why those congressmen had bowed down to the physicists for the last 50 years was the Cold War. Because they somehow imagined all these esoteric equations were going to get them, you know, the smarter missile, the better defense system, blah, blah, blah. But once the Soviet Union collapsed, that kind of went by the wayside, and then you had to start justifying science on other grounds. And what are those other grounds? And I'm saying, go back to the original ones. Or at least, you know, you better come up with something else, because saying aesthetics and that I'm motivated, because it's nice, it keeps you out of trouble, but I don't see why would the taxpayers have to fund this. And I think that's a real issue, okay? You know, why should taxpayers fund this stuff? Especially when you cannot guarantee practical results, right? Because, you know, when you're doing this kind of big physics stuff, right, you're really making the argument for the blue skies here. You're talking about unified comfort. You know, most of this stuff will fail, you know. I mean, in the sense that, it'll be very esoteric. Only a few people will be able to work on it. You have to buy into all that. Why? What? Well, you know, I mean, and the thing is, you know, there's a sense in which you might have to start taking that literally. No, that's right. In fact, that was what the congressman said, you know, get together, work together, more countries doing it, and so forth. Yes, I think that's right. That's what's happened now. But don't you see, there's been a decline in students studying physics and chemistry and over the last 20 years, okay? And if you look at the areas of science that students are going into, they're going into the very practical, money-making areas. That is the trend. In fact, one of the reasons why nanotechnology got invented was to basically find a way of getting physicists and chemists into something they can make money off of. Right? Nanotechnology, you know, that's a kind of made-up thing. It's not like a new field. It's basically physics and chemistry being brought in the service of biotechnology. Okay, I mean, so there is a crisis here. There's a crisis in the labor market and a crisis in the legitimation of these fields that we previously thought were fundamental to science.
Yeah. I don't know if you heard about the study that was done recently. I think it might have been Edinburgh University might be involved in it.
Can you speak a little? Can you pick up what he's saying? Yeah, I need to hear what he's saying. Yeah.
There was a study recently done and an article appeared in The Telegraph, I think, and friends that have worked in laboratories on papers and things have said similar things in their experience that people might have been involved in suppressing data that doesn't fit their theory,
yeah,
or even sort of faking results.
Yeah.
And just wondering sort of what you think might be motivating that, and the fact that this study is showing that it could be on the increase.
Oh, yeah. I've actually written on this kind of topic about this kind of what seems to be this increasing emergence of fraud in science. And not just at the fringes, but at the very centers of science, right? So nature and science are being fooled quite regularly, it seems, by stuff in stem cell research or nanotechnology or whatever. I think the interesting thing about this, and in a way it's a little bit off the beaten path, but I think two things. First of all, why does the fraud get committed? I'm not sure whether the fraud has actually increased so much. We really don't have any way of knowing. But what I do think is that people are now more motivated to check. And why are they motivated to check? Because of the practical consequences of applying the results. Right? So in other words, if you think of the science in purely practical terms, in commercial terms especially, right, you want to know whether this stuff works. And so there's more motivation than there perhaps had been in the past for people to sort of double-check stuff that seems a little too good to be true. Okay. Now, if you look, so that the areas where the fraud tends to be found tend to be in those areas. We're not talking about fraud at the, as it were, fundamental levels of the sciences, but rather than things that potentially have, you know, practical implications. Okay? So, for example, the stem cell stuff in Korea, a guy from a few years ago, and then there was this guy, Hendrik Schoen, and who was working in Bell Labs, a Swiss guy, in nanotechnology and science and nature. And again, both of these things were things that, you know, it was because of the practical consequences of it that they, that first of all, they had been highlighted so much, you know, as news stories, because it was very easy to get a grip on what they were had done, but then they got taken down very easily as well, because other people who wanted to kind of take advantage of this or use it in some way realized the stuff wasn't as it was presented. Okay, but that, when you think about that, that's a really different way of thinking about how you relate to science, isn't it? I mean, it's very much like more at the level of corporate fraud. It's kind of like that.
Okay, if there's no other questions, then I'd like to say thank you very much to all of you for coming, and particularly to thank our speaker. It's been a very lively and interesting evening, and we're very grateful to Professor Fuller for coming and addressing us. Let's thank you.
Thank you.